evening for our last session of the year. We have a treat, and that is we have Don Gagne, who is from National Public Radio, to talk to us about his White House years, because Don is just leaving the White House beat to go to the national political beat. And although he's done a lot of politics over the years, he's certainly covering the Bush and Clinton administrations. And I wonder, Don, if you can tell us how you got to NPR, what your route was, and how you got interested in politics and in journalism. Because some of our students, I think, might be interested themselves in a career in journalism and in politics.
Well, I took a lengthy and circuitous path to a career in journalism and to covering the White House for NPR. I grew up just outside Detroit. I went to Michigan State University and graduated from there in 1979, 1980, depending on when I actually left town. I did not study journalism, and we have a lot of people at NPR who were not journalism majors, people who have come at it from all kinds of different educational and professional backgrounds. But my first job out of college, I never even planned on working in radio. I knew I wanted to write. I thought I would work in television behind the scenes as a writer, as a director, something like that.
What was your major?
I have two majors. One is what they call a telecommunications major, and that gave me a lot of hands-on with the equipment and the gear. And I have a degree in advertising. I even pondered writing ad copy at one point in my life. And you know, they say, thank God it didn't turn out like you planned. Well, that's me. So I'm the only advertising major who works in public broadcasting and doing journalism, I think, anyway. So.
Do they use you for Pledge Week?
When you work in public radio, you learn how to do the Pledge Week. You learn how to give out that 800 number, so I do that. But so I got out of school, and the recession was kind of in full flower, and I just happened to find the job after 6 months or so as a country western disc jockey at the radio station in my hometown. And I thought, well, I can do that. How hard can it be? I found out that I didn't exactly have the chops to be a disc jockey because I was way too self-aware, and you know, the things that come out of your mouth when you're a disc jockey, I was a little too self-conscious, and I was kind of a public radio guy, but I did find out that I loved radio, and I did that job for a year, and when after a year, the guy who had been the one-man news team at this little small-town commercial station left, I took his job. And I became the news director. And all through college, I was a fan of National Public Radio, which was actually, Morning Edition was a brand new show on the air back then. So these were kind of in the early days of NPR. But I was a listener. I was a fan. I modeled my coverage of the Monroe County Commissioners meeting after what I heard Colby Roberts do covering The Hill for National Public Radio. So I was kind of unwittingly training myself for a job that I would get about 3 years later when I became the Detroit Public Radio Station's morning news anchor. I worked for them for a year, all the while, to make a little extra money because the pay was low, freelancing stories on the side to NPR. There were a lot of great stories in Detroit, obviously. Within a couple of years, I was NPR's Detroit Bureau, actually working for NPR, but still in Detroit. And I was doing a mix of things, certainly a lot of urban issues. I was doing a lot of automotive and business stories, a lot of labor stuff because of the UAW and the Teamsters there. And they were the kind of stories that got me on the air all the time. I mean, I was a really regular presence on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And what would happen is every 2 years, every 4 years during the political cycle, if you're the kind of person who can hit a deadline from a rolling bus or whatever, you get pulled in NPR's political coverage because we're always shorthanded. So I started doing that in 94 and 96 and 98. In 2000, I started covering the presidential campaign, spending a week with Gore, then a week with Bush, but always as a fill-in. And it was at the end of the 2000 campaign, kind of out of the blue, they asked me if I'd be interested in moving to Washington from Ann Arbor, one of America's great cities. So I moved from Ann Arbor to Washington to cover the Bush White House. And I am now, as I sit here today, almost 10 years into my 2-year commitment to the job. So that was the path. And I don't know that you can follow that path anywhere other than in public broadcasting, because we still have this strong network of stations. We these days have a growing audience. We have a very devoted listenership. I guess as many of you count yourselves among that listenership. And it is a system that you can really kind of move within, and there's no ceiling. You can always find yourself a next step to go up, move up to.
One of the things that's useful in going to the White House is having a knowledge of policy, because you can use it as a thread in a way of looking at a White House internally and seeing how it operates in light of what they want you to show. You're able to get into it. And I would imagine that one of the advantages for you of covering all of Michigan politics was that you did do the automobile industry, which has an enormous impact nationally, and that you did even politics, but you did urban issues, so you're dealing with housing.
And the labor union, certainly, I mean, back then as now, they were a very powerful political force.
Uh-huh. So was that an advantage for you coming in?
It was an advantage in some ways. When your first job in Washington is the White House, you do feel like you're playing catch-up, because you don't even know where all the buildings are. You don't know the layout of the city, like people who gradually move up and cover the Hill or cover a cabinet agency, and then move into the White House. So in some ways, I felt like I needed to catch up. But there were a lot of ways that I knew I had very intimate, up-close experience covering big issues, that when they hit, and it seems like everything makes its way, every issue makes its way through the White House at some point. It has its moment, either through a legislative initiative of the president or a crisis they had to deal with or whatever. I always felt good when it was an issue that I knew a little something about, that I knew I'd spend a lot more time with than any of my other colleagues in the room. Certainly that was the automotive industry. When the auto bailout rolled around the first months of the Obama administration, I had not covered the auto industry up close in 8 years at that point. But you have a base of knowledge. You have people you know who know you well, who you can call and who can help guide you through some of the more complex issues. And a lot of the people I knew when they were junior and mid-level executives at the car companies and at the union, the equivalent at the union, were in leadership and top management positions. So that helped immensely.
Did it also help that people in the White House knew who you were?
It did, and it helped in two ways. The people in the White House knew who I was because, I mean, it's anybody who's been at the White House for a while knows it's nice when you finally have a turnover at the White House and a new president, and you suddenly have more seniority as a reporter than anybody who works in that West Wing. And there was some NPR at the White House. They do, and they did in the Bush White House as well. But these people at the White House, with the Obama administration, they were very familiar with my work going back to Detroit. So they would be somebody, I was somebody that they would call on when they, were looking for somebody to talk to about this issue, and they knew I would understand it. So that happened a few times anyway, so that was helpful, yeah.
Can you compare how the Bush White House dealt with you and how the Obama administration has?
One thing that struck me was how similar they are. And there are just institutional things about the White House that for all the talk about the press being so cozy with the people we cover, and you really hear it with the Obama administration, that there's this love affair between the press and President Obama. You sure don't feel it when you're there. I mean, it's a constant kind of pushing for information and then pushing back and then closing doors. Now, while there's a lot similar in that they have things they don't want to share, they want to control the message, they want to go over our heads directly to the people. You know, the Bush administration used to do it through live televised speeches and other big events where they felt they could talk directly to people. Now technology has advanced, so Robert Gibbs, the press secretary, is sending out tweets to the general public that he's not sending to us. And the only way we get them is if we happen to be monitoring our Twitter account at the time and we are following him, which we all are, of course. But still, they're producing their own TV shows for the web, and they're producing kind of the weekend review. They're doing all sorts of things that go straight to YouTube, that go directly to their Organizing for America mailing list, so people can get it right in their email, right in their computer, and open it up and watch it without the filter of us. So you see them doing it in probably a more sophisticated way than the Bush White House did. And I say more sophisticated, not because they're better at it, but because technology allows them to do a lot more. The start of the Bush administration, we didn't have BlackBerry. And we didn't have Wi-Fi in all the press filing centers we went to. We would get a hard phone line, because our phones didn't work internationally either, our cell phones. Yeah? So we'd have a hard phone line in every filing center we went to, and we'd have just a little phone jack modem that we'd plug into our computers, not even Ethernet. And we'd dial up, and it would be something like 64K, the connection or something like that. So the technology has changed things more than anything. Now, I will tell you, there are some differences. And some of it is the differences between generic Democratic administrations and generic Republican administrations. And some of it is different because, again, when I started covering the Bush White House, I hadn't covered their campaign full time. I was like a fill-in guy on occasion. So they didn't know me. I mean, they might have known me from the radio, but they didn't know me. At the start of the Obama White House, I had been on his plane for all of 2008, the entire campaign. So there wasn't anybody at any level of the administration that I didn't have some relationship with. And relationships are meaningful. And it's just easier to get information when you have that kind of connection with people. Am I talking too long?
No, that's very interesting. One of the things that struck me about the Obama White House and all of its use of technology is to ask the question, what has it brought them? And it seems to me that as far as his getting across with what he is what he's thinking and what he wants people to know and understand, that it really hasn't moved the needle. If you look at healthcare, and hear his healthcare proposal, it's something that's very beneficial to the middle class. Yet he had this strong wall of opposition to healthcare. And he is a man who is the president, who is very eloquent in his speech, but for all of that, they didn't get across what it was they were going to be doing in that health care, what it meant to individuals. And so I thought that, that it's nice to have Twitter and Facebook and Flickr and whatnot, and a videographer who's doing a West Wing week, but in the long run, the people know more, understand more about what the president is doing.
And the opposition has all the same tools, and they're using them, sometimes to better effect. I mean, sometimes the simple message, and maybe it's the distortion of a fact or a distortion of a position or the clever spin on it, is easier to get out and have it take hold than the very eloquent, sometimes very complicated, very detailed, very thoughtful, longer form message the president would be trying to get out. The other thing on healthcare is there were key moments where you could just see that they were a little slow to respond, and they have learned from it. And I don't know that they've learned the right lessons from it. They've learned now that they have to be faster. But things like the death panels, some of the other more kind of outlandish allegations that were out there, their mindset was, on the face of it, that's just ludicrous. We're not going to dignify it with a response. Certainly the president doesn't need to respond to it. And what happens is within a week or maybe within days, those kinds of things start taking hold as truth. And the polling shows, and I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but the death panel stuff, other things like that, there are a lot of misconceptions about healthcare, as there are misconceptions about the president himself. I mean, look at the large number of people who think he was not born in the United States. It's evidence to how this stuff can take hold. So Robert Gibbs now, the press secretary, will talk about, no internet posting, no tweet, no whatever is too small for them to respond to quickly and even aggressively. It doesn't mean the president doesn't respond to it, because that's something you have to kind of use judiciously and use wisely. But they are very much in the mode that you can't let anything sit out there for hours without some sort of a pushback, for fear that it goes viral and then becomes a truth that then can haunt you the rest of your time in office.
Like where he was born.
Yeah.
Yeah. That just rises every now and then even in the briefing room.
But some of the institutional things that are different. I do find it easier to get somebody from this administration on the phone to have a background discussion with them. Even the Robert Gibbs is kind of a unique press secretary, because he is also a senior advisor to the president. So in effect, he's got two, perhaps three full-time jobs. And when you have multiple full-time jobs, some of them suffer. And the one that does suffer is the one that would be the traditional role of the press secretary, which is kind of establishing relationships and dialogue over the course of the day with reporters. Robert Gibbs has far fewer regularly scheduled briefings than any press secretary I've known in the last decade, and certainly you've tracked it back beyond when I was there. But he has deputies who have been empowered to have meaningful discussions, sometimes on the record, often just on background with reporters. And that is very different from the Bush administration. You can almost always find somebody to go to have a conversation, to look for clarification, to look for information, to look for whatever it is you need on your story before you go on the air with it. So that is different. Somebody once said, early on in the beat, I asked a colleague what was the difference between the Bush years and the then relatively recent Clinton years. And they said, the difference is, and I have found this to be true, Republicans will stonewall you and say, we'll tell you what you need to know when you need to know it. And you're kind of pulling teeth. They just tend to be more secretive. Democrats tend to leak like crazy. Though this administration doesn't leak that much, unless it wants to, unless their plan is targeted leaks. But again, the other thing about Democrats is, and this is a cartoon, but in a caricature, but there is some truth in it. They so believe in the rightness and the power of their ideas that they're not going to tell you what the Republicans do, which is go away and we'll tell you when we're ready. They invite you in and they have these lengthy discussions with you, discussing where the policy came from, what its motivations were, how it's going to work, convinced that once you hear everything they have to say, that of course you will agree with the brilliance of their plan. And those are two very different philosophies, and I don't know that one is more right than the other or one is more effective than the other. But as a reporter, you do like it when somebody is willing to overshare.
Yeah. The president is very believes that. He has talked many times about how he can just go into a room and talk to people. He may not be able to persuade them that he's going to have an understanding.
Mm-hmm.
They'll know why it is, and he's doing what he's doing, and appreciate what
Yeah, he likes to build kind of that foundation for understanding.
Yeah.
And again, he doesn't expect to convince everybody in the room, but he thinks he'll get a lot of them.
Uh-huh.
And he thinks he can get the people who might be on the fence, if only they can understand the full context, the full background. He's a very contextual guy. He likes to provide the biggest of big pictures for people to see how this particular policy fits into that.
One of the differences that I think I've seen in Republican and Democratic White Houses is that Republican White Houses are very hierarchical, and people have particular areas they work in. They're not anywhere near as many people who work laterally. In a Democratic administration, there is a lot less interest in an organization chart. And so you can often find people that their titles may not be indicative of the reach that they have and the times when they see a president. So in a way, there are more people that you can deal with, too.
And that does hold true. I've covered the Bush White House, and now I've covered the Obama White House, but I think I would agree with that. The rule in the Bush White House seem to be much more clearly defined, even the symbolic ones, which included you always put a jacket on, a suit coat on when you walk into the Oval Office, and no jeans in the entire West Wing, even after hours, and all that kind of stuff. So it was more rigid and more hierarchical. And in some ways, almost a throwback to the 50s, to the early 60s, in terms of the kind of personal vibe around there.
Yeah, that's true. Kind of a real sense of rules.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that at one point there were senior people in the Bush administration who were upset when they saw a picture of Obama with his feet on the desk and talked about how he never was there without a jacket. And so there are pictures that started surfacing of
yes.
Bush without a jacket.
Yes, yes, yeah.
It wasn't often that he did that, but that was the case.
And some of the pushback immediately from the Obama folks was, and I think it might have come from Axelrod or somebody, was, they left such a mess, we needed to take our jackets off and roll up our sleeves to get to work. But.
Well, one of the things you can see in looking at the interactions that the president has with the press is your point of how he likes to have contact when he's talking. And so when he's dealing with the press, he doesn't like to be in situations where he's going to be asked to comment on something that he isn't familiar with all of the parts.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to want to have a great deal of information before he speaks. And so what that's resulted in charting the various forums where the president meets the press is comparing Obama with Bush and Clinton. He doesn't meet the press except for an interview, but the White House press corps is a group. He doesn't meet anywhere near the amount of time that Bush and Clinton did. And if you look at the short Q&As, I divide mine into three different parts. First press conferences, short and solo, then short Q&As, like in the Oval Office.
Where there's one, two, three tops shouting questions.
Right, right, usually from the wires. And then interviews as the third type. And this is the way they break down. In short Q&As, Obama in his first year had 46, and Bush had 147, and Clinton had 252. And in press conferences, they're somewhat similar. Obama, 27, 11 solo, 16 joint, but four of those solo were nighttime interviews for the news drum. Bush, 19, 4 solo, 15 joint. Clinton, 45, 14 solo, and 31 joint. And so you can see Clinton obviously was doing a lot more, but if we look at the third type interviews, that's where you see where Obama is really spending his time, where he had 161 interviews, and Bush had 15, and Clinton had 53.
That number astounds me, 161 in
a year.
A year.
And I went back to Bush, one, and in his first year, I think it's 60, he had 60, which is very much similar to Bush, Taylor, and Clinton.
The thing people don't realize, too, is the degree to which they are able to control the nature of an interview. The questions are not submitted in advance. I mean, that's a very common misconception people have about us. They think, to get called on at a press conference, you have to submit your question in advance, and if they like it, they'll call on you. We really heard that a lot during the Bush years, and that's not the case. And same with press conferences. Nobody submits their list of questions so the president can do his homework before you go in and sit down. But these are media savvy people. They know something about how we work, how we think, and at a press conference, they're able to, in their strategy sessions and rehearsals that they do have, probably game out 90% of the questions that are going to be asked. I mean, first they know X number are going to come out of the news of the day, and here's how they're likely to be put together. Even here's how so-and-so is likely to ask this question, because we know we've watched him for 10 years or whatever it is. But in an interview, it's more freewheeling, but when they grant the interview determines what the primary topic is going to be. And all they have to do is kind of be prepared for that one, maybe two oddball question. But invariably, that is what gets them in trouble. And I use the word trouble in quotes. It's the thing they don't quite anticipate that he gives a too candid answer to. Sometimes they kind of cut to the bone. This was a press conference, and this is the last time the president has had a full solo primetime news conference without another world leader standing next to him. When it went for a full hour, it was in July, I think. July 22nd of 2009, so we're coming up on a year since he's had one of these. And I confess, I forget what the main topic of the news was that day.
I think their hook was healthcare.
It was healthcare. It was getting ready for the final push on healthcare because he wanted it passed by the fall. And sure enough, most of the questions were predictable and along those lines. But at the end, he had asked the question about the incident in Cambridge where Professor Gates had been arrested trying to break into his own home. A black professor, a white police officer, arrested him trying to get into his own home late at night after a flight where his key wouldn't work or he lost his key. And the president, I might be overstating a little bit, but said what the police did was stupid. Condemned the police action. He didn't know all the facts, but he did know Professor Gates, and he was clearly, representing from his point of view. And guess what became the news for 3 or 4 days? That answer, healthcare, was just lost. And if you look to the left, you could see Axelrod and Gibbs and Rahm Emanuel in the room watching this press conference, and they had been so pleased with how the thing had gone until that moment, and their faces all just kind of drooped, because they knew what the storyline was for the next 3 days. And this is a president who, despite his being the first African-American president, has always downplayed the racial component of his presidency. He is always, when asked questions about it, is always, I represent all Americans, and, we lift all, we raise the tide and all boats are lifted. It's kind of an approach. And here he was walking right in the middle of this heated racial discussion. And they only diffused it when they had, the now famous beer summit on the little patio.
One of the things that surprised me about that was that I was in Hawaii at the time, but I knew three people who were going to ask that question, and in Hawaii. So why did they not prepare?
It's a really good point, because I mean, you're right. I kind of just now described it as almost among those kind of unexpected questions.
Yeah.
That is the mystery. That is the mystery. It was the last question, and it was a question that. Had he not called on that last person, it would have never come.
Yeah.
It was Lynn Sweet.
Yeah.
Well, you almost wonder if he wanted to talk about it, but you can't imagine that this is the script they had prepared for this answer.
One thing that hit me about that, and let me compare it to another response, is the response by George Bush, is that. Presidents, one of the hazards of press conferences is presidents get tired by the end. And they don't, they just are not as careful in choosing their words as they are in the beginning.
An hour is a long time.
It is. And you might remember the press conference that Bush had in the briefing room, where at the end of it, it was during the period when gas prices were starting to go up.
Was the Peter Mayer question?
It was Peter Mayer's question about expert say.
Peter Mayer is CBS Radio.
And that they're going up to $4 a gallon. And Bush said, what experts? You know, I haven't heard anything like that.
And he even said something like, what? $4 a gallon? Really? He seemed stunned.
He did.
It was like that moment of his father at the checkout counter at a grocery store at some photo op. And it was the first time his dad had ever seen the scanner. For pricing items, and his dad said, oh, look at that, that's neat. And even 20 plus years ago, that was not exactly new technology.
Yeah.
And it makes you seem unconnected to the realities of everyday life for the majority of America.
Right. And,
or the bad thing.
Yeah. So it's a hazard that you have at the press conference.
And that was, not a gotcha question. It was a simple question. Mr. President, gasoline may hit $4 according to experts. What does that say? I mean, it was something like that, right?
Yeah.
It's a very straightforward, not even a gotcha question.
Yeah.
But his answer might have been very different had it been first.
Yeah, so it looks like what I know in Obama, when he's done short Q&As, that his answers have tended to be long and not easy to dissect. And sometimes leaving more questions than they settle, like when he was asked about the effort in Congress to create a torture commission, and what did he think? And his answer, he was sitting in the Oval Office because it was at the door. And his answer, the question was about, I think, 10 words, and his answer was 718. And it caused grief for Gibbs for a couple of weeks because more and more questions came up. What did he say? For the commission or against the commission, you think Congress can do it. What does that mean? He's in favor of it. And so the same thing with immigration. When he came back to the press area on Air Force One recently and was talking about immigration, does it mean that we have to hold it over? Did he say that nothing should be done now? And did they try to walk back from that pretty quickly with the Arizona case?
There was one press conference overseas recently, I think, where he was asked a question and the answer went on for 17 minutes.
Uh-huh.
One answer to a single question.
Yeah. Right.
And it's just kind of a blizzard of words, and he's following a train of thought and a certain line of thinking. And sometimes it's not until you go back and listen to the answer again and look at the transcript of it. That all of those questions come up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it can sound reasonably complete and, all of that in real time.
Mm-hmm.
But if when you have a chance to really look at the words on the page, that you do, and sometimes it's within 10 minutes when you go, wait a minute, of course, by now he's gone.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, with an interview, he can obviously go into depth, like talking to David Lanhart, we're also talking to, he talks to segmented audience. So he does a lot of mocking at radio. And recently he did an interview with an Indonesian television station. And these are things we don't even say.
Right.
Where he's speaking to a
and they don't release transcripts either.
Yes. Right. Yeah, because they're the property of the news organization. So what is that, how difficult does that make it for having few Q&As, few press conferences? How difficult does that make it for the White House press corps to get a sense of who the president is?
It's, you feel like it's much more controlled. You have to go elsewhere for the information, and it's others within the building. It's people outside the building who have had conversations with the White House or a hand in developing the policy. So it just makes you work different avenues. You don't always get the best information from the president either. You might just be getting, spin from him too. Obviously, any chance you get, you want to have the principal him, there to answer questions. And for the press, as much as we all like interviews, none of us gets a lot of interviews. And when somebody else is doing an interview with them, it is frustrating because they don't ask the follow-up you would have asked, or they don't follow the line of questions that you would have followed, and they don't think what you think is important is important. So that is why you really do like that setting of the formal press conference where everybody's there and you know he's going to take 15 or maybe 20 questions over the course of an hour plus, because there's a certain organic quality to it. You don't get a lot of follow-up questions just because the home field advantage that they have means you stand up, you ask your question, and the mic is gone, and you can't really interrupt an answer as much. It's just logistically it's hard to do in that setting with the microphones and all that. But what I like to do when I'm sitting there is listen carefully to every answer and be prepared to stand up with the follow-up or the repeated variation on a question that was dodged. And you either make them dodge it again, which is telling, or maybe you get something the second time. So I do, it's not that it's a pack mentality, because we all go in there with our own questions and our own ideas, but there is a certain organic quality to it where you do feel like you have a better shot at getting kind of a candid moment and maybe getting answers to some of these questions. Now, your questions are just not going to answer. You can't, unfortunately, twist their arm behind their back and, they say, "Uncle, okay, I'll answer everything you have, truthfully and completely." But it does, to me, it does feel like that, the entire group, and there are a lot of bright people in the White House press corps, kind of having an hour of sustained questioning where the questions can come from anywhere on any topic, is always a pretty interesting and revealing exercise and worthwhile exercise.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions about the White House, but about coverage generally. In the White House, there is so much information they give out in a lot of these different forums, but there's a lot of information out about what he's doing, what proposals they have, what impact it would have. And there's a lot of information out there on everything, whether it's on blogs or traditional news organizations or new ones. So in some ways, we don't have a shortage of information. We really have an enormous amount of information. The difficulty is bringing understanding to that information. And that seems to me one of the things that's always been your strength, and it's been the strength of NPR. Is that something that you all talk about as part of your coverage?
We do. I mean, obviously, your news agenda is driven, to some degree by events and by the calendar and by the congressional calendar. And when things are introduced, but we try not to be a total slave to that. And I think it's our colleague Chuck Todd from NBC and MSNBC who describes that process that you're talking about, all of this information that comes at you. He says covering the White House is like standing in the fire hose. It's just constantly, there's always stuff that they're putting out, paper after email after announcement after speech after fact sheets and position papers and all of that. We at NPR, I mean, we do have a lot of discussions about what the important story of the day is, whether or not it comes from the White House, if it does come from the White House team, how we approach it, who we talk to, whether, sometimes you do, the president gives an important speech. So the next day or that afternoon, your story is, here's what he said. And you have to do that. And we provide context in our programming by following it with interviews with, a variety of people or pieces from our member stations in Detroit or our bureau in Los Angeles where the impacts of this policy or whatever will be felt, or from on the ground in Afghanistan or Baghdad or Islamabad or wherever. We have bureaus and reporters everywhere. So we flesh out that story of the speech with those kinds of things and interviews and commentaries. And the nice thing about NPR is we can devote, if we want to, an entire two-hour show to that. I mean, all things considered, it's a two-hour show every night with no commercials. I mean, there are cutaway breaks where stations do local news and traffic and this and that. But and we do underwriting credits. But in an hour, the bulk of that hour, 50 minutes of that hour is devoted to us covering the news, compared to 38 minutes of that hour at a commercial station. Not to mention kind of the other considerations they have trying to get ratings. Story selection. So we have a lot of discussions about how we can turn this story over many different ways and how we can tell it many different ways. And I let others be the judge of how well we do it. But it's refreshing to be able to look at a story that way. And I can't tell you how many times I'd find myself either in my White House booth or on the road traveling with the president. And all of the radio guys sit together in the back, and the TV folks sit in another place, and the newspaper people sit together. They kind of segregate us by medium because our needs are similar. But I would look around, and I would be doing a very different story than what my colleagues were doing that day. And it doesn't mean they weren't doing fine stories, but our perspective, and it's like our mission is different. So it gives us license to look at things.
How do you know what the mission is when you knew it, I guess, coming in, because you were preparing yourself for NPR?
Yeah.
But is there any discussion about it, about what the mission is?
We do have a very simple mission statement, which I wish I could recite. I can't. But I can tell you what, I mean, it is a reflection of what we are.
Uh-huh.
And it is to help people, understand their world around them, by presenting stories in a thoughtful way, in a thorough way, in a way that respects their intelligence, every single day, and which seeks to, kind of illuminate, the issues of the day. I mean, it does sound kind of like a new agey mission statement. But in our journalism, what that means is on every story, we attempt to explain it as best we can. We attempt to present the facts as fairly as we can. And we attempt to tell it through eyes and through ways that you might not have thought of otherwise. And we have the luxury of time to do that.
Are you doing the Atlanta Cable story?
Only peripherally. Because I'm literally just phasing out of the White House, kind of officially in the last week. So I am, like, tonight I had a piece on about the Arlen Specter, Joe Sestak, Democratic primary. Specter, of course, the incumbent, a longtime Republican, running as a Democrat for the first time as a senator in Pennsylvania. And the Kagan nomination has complicated that race for Specter, because when she came up for her current job for hearings to be Solicitor General a year ago, roughly, Specter was still a Republican and voted against her. And now you would think a Democratic U.S. Senator is likely to support their Democratic president on a nomination like this, but it's complicated for Specter. And what it is mostly is a reminder to Democratic primary voters of what he was not long ago, a Republican. Again, he was always a different kind of Republican, but he had many moments where he was loyal to kind of the Republican line and to the Bush administration and the like. So that's been the only way I've touched the Kagan story, is kind of through some of these other political stories.
I think let's get into our questions. Telson?
Yeah, hi. Keeping on the sort of Elena Kagan story here, which I know you said that you were focusing on more peripherally, and also tying it in with Specter. I was wondering if you'd noticed in the Obama administration, the New York Times has what I think is a really good analysis article on it today about how the Obama administration has been less focused on its base, per se, as being moderate and picking like a Kagan, someone who can bring people together to the table, that sort of thing, rather than someone who's an outspoken liberal version of, say, Scalia or Alito. I was wondering if you noticed, as a White House correspondent, a difference. Is the Obama administration really less focused on its base than the Bush administration was?
My quick answer would be yes, if you define its base as the kind of hardcore liberal wing of the party. I don't know that they see it that way. I mean, I do think they see themselves as centrist, maybe, center-left Democrats. And I think they also see as their base, the independents who help elect the president. Independents went for him by a large margin in 2008. So I think they always look at it more broadly. I do think, even having said that, that Kagan is very consciously kind of a moderate pick, more so than the last nomination, Sotomayor. And it's the kind of pick that you see in the middle of a brutal primary year, midterm election year, with all these primaries going on. Not of which is to say they don't love her as a pick, and they're not really happy with her as a pick, but she is the kind of pick you would expect this time in the election cycle, and they're very mindful of that, even though they'll never talk about that on the record. Does that make sense? Does that get to your question?
What are the benefits of the background that she has for them? What are some of the things you think that drew them to her at this particular time period?
I think they do like to say, she isn't a judge. I mean, I think they like, she's a different kind of pick in that regard. I think they see her as someone who can and will be a real intellectual force on the bench. I think they see her as someone who builds consensus and coalitions, and they love the idea of having someone, a nominee of theirs, who can do what you see Scalia doing from a more, much more conservative perspective. And I think he's always admired. I do think they are looking at her in particular, not so much in the kind of decisions she'll make, but how she will function in this kind of number of political bodies.
In following him this as long as you did, and in watching his presidency, where do you see his being a constitutional expert, who has taught constitutional law, where do you see that coming in to his presidency and what he's done?
It's a good question. I don't know that I can think of a good example. I mean, you see some of it in the, you know, in the desire to close Guantanamo Bay, the detainee camp down there. But you also see the practical side of camp, which is why it's still open when it was supposed to have been closed by now. You see it in, I mean, these are all legal issues, so many of them are terrorism. Someone commits an act someplace, you have the trial there, and suddenly there's the uproar over whether or not a trial should be held, you know, so close to ground zero in New York City, and they're backing down from that. So you see efforts to kind of impose some level of kind of constitutional purity, or whatever the word would be, as he sees it. Some of these areas in very controversial ways, but they do kind of push up against political and practical realities, and then you see him making accommodations. But I don't even know if those are great examples. I don't know that I can think of any others just off the top of my head.
I wonder in years to come when we look at, like, say, we can get into materials and the preparation for the choices of the Supreme Court and what the two presidents were interested in, say Bush and Obama. I wonder that if we'll find, I can remember on one of the people interviewed for, I guess it must have been for the Alito job, I don't think it was for the Roberts one position, that it was said that Bush hadn't struck it off well with the particular person, and that having a feeling of camaraderie seemed to be an important aspect of it, of what he felt for that person, a personal kind of response. And I wonder if that's not as important, say, for Obama, that for Obama what he's looking for was particular ideas about the law.
Yeah, and it's more of an intellectual kind of assessment that he's making. I will be very interested to read some of these things as they come up.
Somebody takes
Well, and you know, in that regard, it is how Bush shocked us all when he nominated Harriet Myers, his legal counsel to the Supreme Court, and there was shock on the part of a lot of people, including a lot of liberals. But the real anger came from conservatives, and they saw it as a betrayal, and that caught Bush off guard. He knew her, he liked her, she had a great legal mind, and all of those things made her a fine choice for him. And that's one in particular I'm really interested in. To see all the notes and diaries and things that will eventually become available at some point way down the road.
And that's true, and to see what the process was, because there's normally, and when he was making decisions, there was a whole process of, you know, deputy to principal on decisions. And that one looked like it slipped in the sideways. I think Karl Rove was working on his legal issues at that time.
Catherine,
you
You spoke about the different media factions and how they at times have dissimilar interests, and thus they pursue different questions. Thus, does the president use this to his advantage in picking different media representatives who may ask a certain question or bring up a certain issue at a conference that he may give an answer to that might advantage him in, I guess, giving the certain kind of message that he wants to give off?
I think he does. I think he does. Now, he can't control it completely because he doesn't know for sure what, you know, any given person is going to ask when they call on them. But, I mean, an example, when the bailout of General Motors and Chrysler was still a going thing, and there was a lot of talk, will they be forced into bankruptcy, will they not? He did have a press conference in there, and I can tell you the president, I mean, I can't think of another time when either President Bush or Obama called on one of the Detroit newspapers. Now, the Detroit newspapers, for many years, had a very strong presence in Washington. They had Washington bureaus and all that, but as their readership has declined and as they've gone through what so many newspapers have gone through, and in Detroit it's all complicated by the terrible economy there, so it's even worse. But lo and behold, there was a reporter from the Detroit News, I believe it was. It could have been the Free Press, but I think it was the News.
Deb Price.
It was Deb Price. Is she in the News, I think? I think she's in the News. My friends in Detroit are, shame on me for not knowing this, but I think she's
next to me.
Yeah. At any rate, and he knew the question was going to be about the auto industry, and he knew he wanted to give a long answer, and it almost didn't matter what the question was. He used it to launch into a pretty lengthy explanation of where they're coming from on this and why they're proceeding the way they are. So he had reasons to want to get that question, so we found a way to make sure he got it, even if it wasn't a plant, as you might think of a plant. The press secretary does this too. I mean, if there's a particular line of heated questioning in any given daily briefing by the press secretary, I say daily, but they're not daily that much anymore under this administration. There are people in the room who, are known for asking this kind of question or that, and maybe somebody asks a question that's usually kind of humorous or one that's off the wall. You can almost feel the press secretary going to that person just to kind of let the air out of the pressure that is building in their room at times. So it is in their power to guess who might ask what kind of a question. And they ultimately get to call on who they want to call on, when they want to call on them. They get to answer the questions they choose to answer, or dodge the questions they choose to answer. Again, they can't always say for sure that, you know, that reporter from the Columbus Dispatch isn't going to stand up and just surprise them and ask the last question they would ever want to be asked on this day. But they can make pretty educated guesses, and they do kind of gauge the feeling in the room as the press conference is proceeding.
Yeah. In a way, you would expect Lynn Sweet, who asked the question about Gates, is a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. And so he knew her, mm-hmm. and he probably thought that it was going to be a Chicago question.
Mm-hmm.
And
God knows there were Chicago questions to be asked at that stage. I don't know if the Olympic bid was still a going thing or whatever, but yeah.
Another
question?
Yes. I was wondering if you think that the reason that this White House pushes back against the media so much is because of their trouble staying on message.
I don't know that's it. Some days they're good at staying on message, some days they're not so good at staying on message. I think they push back just because, I mean, that is what a White House does. I don't know that they push back any more than the Bush White House did. I mean, one thing is interesting, though, is the difference between the Obama campaign press operation and the White House press operation. And the campaign was known for its nimble response, for always getting back to you very quickly, for always having somebody available. And until we got you know, the last couple of months, the candidate was even available with real regularity. Coming back on the plane or having a plane side press conference on the tarmac or whatever it was. And they had many, many, many ways, all these new ways through social media and Twitter and everything else to get the message out fast, not just to us, but to all of those people who had sent in their emails and made a dollar contribution or whatever it was. I mean, so many people had signed up for the Obama for America emails. So they were really nimble and really quick and, I can say it objectively, really effective. I mean, they won. They vanquished all opposition when the odds were very long, especially when we think back to that cold day in Springfield in February of 07 when he announced his candidacy and everybody thought it was way too early and it was crazy because this is Hillary's nomination. Once they got to the White House, I mean, things do get a lot more complicated. And I think you can probably look at every White House there. The transition is there to help you get ready to govern. But the transition is also when jobs are filled. And a lot of the jobs aren't filled in time for the start of the administration. And there just is a learning curve for everybody at a White House when they come in. And it's not just a learning curve about suddenly you're speaking to the president. The job is way more complicated than a campaign. And the issues are way more complicated. And the campaign, the prism that you look through so many things, almost everything, is that how will this affect us and how will it affect us as a candidate in relation to how it affects our opponent. And it's a binary equation once you get to the general election. It may be a little more complicated in the primaries, but even so, you only have a few other people you have to worry about. And the other thing is, it's all geared toward winning next month's primary, or winning next week's caucus, or winning the November election. It's much more chaotic when you get to the White House, and it's not you against one person. It's you and, the whole country making judgments about this complicated issue, like healthcare or Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's just a harder message to sell, and it's a harder message to win the message game, just because it's so much more complicated. So many things are flying at them every day, and there's so many unpredictable things.
Uh-huh. And in a campaign, let's say a spokesman can say something about an economic issue or an economic crisis, like say in Europe, perhaps. And when you get to the White House, you can't talk about markets. Mm-hmm. If you talk about something that relates to a market, it can have a real impact, which happened from a gaggle.
Everything carries so much more weight
yeah.
when it comes from a microphone at the White House.
And so you have to pass it through so many different filters that you can't really just bring it out. And governing is so different. You don't control it. You control part of it. But most of what you want to do requires the Congress. And so you can't afford to say the same kinds of things. I wonder if one aspect of the relationship between the White House and the press now and the heat that seems to be in it comes from the nature of how they communicate, because they often communicate by email. And email is a harsh form of communication. Even somebody can read an article, get mad about it, hit the send button, and then, a reporter's getting a hair fire.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, decades ago, you didn't have that available than maybe a press secretary or, you know, various White House officials would wait before they contacted the reporter. Or the same thing of reporters contacting the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So that in part the kind of the conduit is important.
It's interesting, and it sounds funny to say this because we're also used to email, and email is even kind of passe now, you know, with other electronic means between texting and Facebook and Twitter and everything else. We're all using those. But at the start of the Bush years, I mean, certainly we had email 10 years ago, and it was the way to get all the transcripts, and it was the way to get all the announcements, and it was the way to, communicate. But most of my contacts at the start of the Bush years, when I wanted to talk to somebody in the press office or wherever, was by picking up the phone and calling them, or wandering up there and hanging out in the hallway until you see somebody that you slip in. And the last couple of years, the vast majority of my contacts, unless I'm on the campaign bus or the plane or some mode where we're all in this enclosed area traveling together with nothing to do but look at each other. But most of it is email. Most of it is email. And it becomes quicker, it becomes more impersonal. And it's not just email. It's email on the BlackBerry. So it's shorthand email.
Right.
It's, can you confirm? I'm hearing X about Y. Can I go with it? Deadline. Thanks. Thanks in advance, and then you get the note back that says, cool, you can go with that, attribution, senior administration official. And you're thrilled to get that, and it was a lot faster, a lot more efficient than making the phone call and making the call back, and they do this while they're still sitting in the meeting that they couldn't pick up their phone during. And you're doing this while you're
in a briefing,
and you didn't dare speak out loud because you'd blow your scoop with all your colleagues. So it's just different, and it's not that it's totally impersonal. It's not, but it is different. And you are right. Sometimes you get that brutal email from somebody who heard your story. Heard the first half of your story, got beat off, and fires the angry email, and you just know, and the thing they're complaining about, you addressed in the last half of your story, but they weren't listening to it because they took that time to quit listening and fire off the note. But there's still no substitute for the interpersonal, the personal relationship. Riding a campaign bus with people and getting to know them and they do all that. I mean, that all makes your job easier. It is where the level of trust that comes in so handy so much of the time is established. That and what you do on the air and what you do with the information when you get it and all that. But it's all changing and it's changed even in the last couple of years.
But they're continuity, like you're talking about trust and establishing trust. Now, it wouldn't make a difference, say, from when you started in Detroit, that you had to have that kind of relationship with your sources.
Right.
And so that's something that today is still very much at the heart of reporting.
I mean, my first day on the automotive beat felt, an awful lot like the first day at the White House. There's a scrum with Lee Iacocca or somebody who was around back then. And you walk in and you realize that this group of eight people in the scrum, you're the one who's never met him before. And you just, by its very nature, you're having a different conversation with him than they are. He knows their shorthand, they know his. That's just reporting. That's just getting to know people and being around and proving yourself.
Would you say that what is the story is pretty much the same over that time period, what the elements are that you're going to be looking for?
Mostly. I mean, what was a good story is a good story. and if that hasn't changed at all. And that's, you know, for NPR and the New York Times and the Washington Post. But there are a lot of stories now that didn't used to be stories. You hang out in the White House for the day, and there are a lot of reporters who are filing only for blogs. And over the course of the day, they might file 100 things. And there are things that would have never made that one story that you do at the end of the day, or the story you do for Morning Edition, and then later for All Things Considered, the updated story. But because there are outlets from Politico to newspapers, the New York Times now has, you know, the Caucus blog, and the Chicago Tribune has the Swamp, and NPR has the Two Way, and there are things that I will observe. I mean, I don't know that I've done this yet, but if it happened tomorrow, I would do it. If I'm walking up the driveway of the White House and the president's dog is kind of rolling around 3 feet from me, sunning himself, and it's a gorgeous day, and it's really easy to take my BlackBerry out and shoot a picture with the camera, and it takes a really nice, high resolution photo, I'll send that as an email all on my walk up the driveway to the guy who does the NPR blog, the Two Way. And I'll say, look what I saw in the driveway today. And next thing you know, it's posted.
Well, I saw him. I saw the dog at, it must have been at the end of last Friday. And it, in a way, it was a nice picture. I didn't have my phone with me, so I didn't take it.
But it's not like is it a superficial story? Yes. Are there a lot of people who want to look at that picture? We clearly know there are, because of the number of hits it gets. But did I take away from my day doing more serious coverage on Elena Kagan or Ilker or whatever it is? No, because I was able to do all that with, and barely break stride on my way up to the White House, and the picture is sent and a little note is typed in before I get to my booth. And it all happens on that little 2 minute walk because the technology lets you do it. So there are a lot of things that are stories now. And then you tear your hair out because you look at the most viewed stories or whatever that our website, just like every other news organization website, tracks. And that one has, 10,000 people who clicked on it. And your thoughtful analysis of the Inspector Sestak race in Pennsylvania had 25 people click on it.
Listen, the guy who was walking and had a suit on, so it was a nice picture. But April had that happen where she was walking up the driveway in the Bush administration, and a reporter went over to Pat Barney, and she just got the fifth camera, so she had her camera on. So, and Barney did the reporter.
Yeah,
and that
right.
Ended up having several hundred thousand views.
Yeah.
So you're right about that.
Dog bites man is not a story unless it's the president's dog in the Rose Garden and the man is the reporter. Yeah.
Well, one last question. I think we're about out of our time. We still have some more. Yeah. So we have time for three more.
Anybody?
Yeah, any
thinkers
here?
How's it going? It's me again.
like Obama and the beer summit thing. This is a question that's going to get me, right? So go ahead. I'm sorry.
You were talking about using Twitter, or not Twitter, but taking the photo on your BlackBerry and uploading it to your weblog. I was wondering if you ever, when you're posting those things, have like the concern that, well, maybe this is taking away from the legitimacy of the journalism, because it's sort of. That's sort of like fluff journalism is the sort of thing that you see them making fun of a lot on shows like The Daily Show or The Colbert Report. Do you ever think about like cutting those things out, or are they too big a draw in terms of website views?
It's not even that I'm doing it for the website views. It's funny. It's a good question, and the first answer is I don't think it suddenly makes National Public Radio look superficial, because I think anybody who listens to NPR and pays attention to NPR knows that there's a lot of very serious journalism going on. But it's also it's why All Things Considered is called, was always called All Things Considered. Because, you know, there's always the story in that when it was an hour and a half show and a 2 hour show, that is, you know, a story that somebody, you know, one person considers it light, one person considers it a humorous little kind of, you know, a slice of life, another person might consider it frivolous. But it's kind of always been in there. I mean, you know, my colleague Susan Stamberg, who is in the Broadcasting Hall of Fame and is one of the icons of American journalism, and just got an honorary degree at the University of Michigan last week or the week before, the same day President Obama got his. I mean, she's one of the giants of American broadcasting and journalism. And I remember 25 years ago listening to Susan do an interview with our science reporter where they went into a dark closet and took their microphones with them, and they bit into like various flavors of breath mints to see the phosphorus glow in the dark sparking as they did it. Why do I remember this story? Because I found it quite hysterical. Now there was perhaps, you know, a scientific message in there, which I kind of forget all these many years later. But that's the kind of piece that somebody, you know, I mean, it's, you might consider it superficial. I guess I feel like there's no harm in taking that photo of something interesting. You know, maybe the president's dog isn't the best example. I mean, it might also be, I mean, there was, and this is something I did. I was walking up to the White House one day, and I noticed that the POW MIA flag was flying from the flagpole, from the staff, right below the American flag on the top of the White House. I've never seen that flying up there before. So I clicked a picture with my cell phone camera and sent it in, and we kind of posted that, too. It's something I would have never done or mentioned or perhaps even noticed. I mean, I guess I would have noticed it on another day. So certainly if the pictures of Bo start to outweigh the analysis of, you know, what's in the health care bill, then we have a problem. But I think there's room for us to kind of meet the spirit of All Things Considered digitally and on the web as well, and just kind of put that stuff out there. And again, that stuff does tend to live on our blog that's on our webpage, that you have to kind of go there looking for it. So it has a different vibe from, you know, Morning Edition or All Things Considered, which are more kind of the show of record for our network for the day anyway.
One of the things about this White House is the people are really very interested in everything Obama, right down to the four paws and the dog. So in a way, it's responding to the kind of interest that people have. His personalities, the president of the first lady. They just simply are news. Everything about them is news. One thing I'd like to ask is, most news organizations seem to have reduced circulation. They have more readers. Like for newspapers now have more readers with their circulation. So their hard copies have fallen a lot. NPR has had a growing audience, and so you have, 28 million?
28 million listeners, even more for our newscasts, which are the top of the hour, you know, shorter presentations that go around the clock.
Yeah. And you've increased the number of viewers.
We have.
That you have. How are you in that situation, and in all the other news organizations, so many of the people that we've had speak to us or with organizations that they're having to deal with reduced circumstances in every way.
We did have a tight budget and still have a tight budget, and we had some layoffs last year, I think 60-some layoffs. A journalist, a lot of them, eliminated a complete show day-to-day. We took furlough days, and we did a lot of the things in our contract in terms of granting concessions. Because last year, the last 2 years, were really tough in terms of our revenue. But the thing that I'm very pleased to be working for NPR is, for us, it's like we were weathering a tough economic time. It wasn't that we were confronting systemic changes in the way we do our business and what we do and how people use our product. There are changes, but we've been able to adapt and ride that wave, I think pretty effectively. But it's true. When I filed my first story for NPR back in 1986, it was a freelance story. I remember talking to my mom and telling her 6 million people could hear this story. And that was 1986, so 25 years later. In those 25 years, you look what's happened in newspapers, you look what's happened in the network TV news broadcast, you look at the fragmentation of the news market, and everybody is kind of doing with fewer, lower circulation and fewer eyeballs and all that. For our audience to more than quadruple in that time, I think it's a remarkable thing. And now we're discovering a good chunk of our audience. I mean, it's still a majority, but it is a minority, but it's a growing number experience NPR, not through the radio. You know, especially younger demographics, they're listening to us on their iPhone, live streaming, and our iPhone and our iPad apps are fabulous ways to kind of interface and still get an audio product because they're multimedia, but also experience all sorts of other enhancements to any given audio story with charts and data and photos and all kinds of things. So we're adapting and we're doing well, and as we emerge from this tough economic time, hopefully we're going to be just fine and continue to grow.
What are the demographics of your audience?
Politically, if you ask them to self-identify, a third say they're liberal, a third say they're moderate, a third say they're conservative. So we're evenly divided. And when you think of it, you can't grow to 28 million people unless you're reaching a wide swath, in terms of opinion and all that, in terms of who your listeners are. We tend to be, I don't want to the wrong numbers, but the core of our audience is 35 plus. But again, through digital media and all that, which is where most of our growth has been in the building, our strength there is in attracting college kids in the 18 to 29. So there's growth there. There's a way to go. But in terms of kind of a serious product, it's always new skin. A little older, anyway.
Geographically,
we are strong everywhere. I mean, we're really strong on college campuses. Uh-huh. If I go to Ann Arbor or wherever, Austin, and college campuses, everybody's a listener. Everybody's a listener. Less so in rural areas. A lot of competition in big cities, other media markets. But we also do really well in a state like Wyoming, where there is a very strong state public radio network, often licensed to the universities. So the universities, all educational institutions are paying for the equipment and the hardware and the facilities and paying the salaries of the staff, they do the fundraising that all stations do, but it allows radio professionals to work in smaller towns. Alaska Public Radio is another great example, where if they were in commercial radio, they wouldn't be able to make a living, just because the economics are such that you're kind of a minimum wage or barely better, oftentimes if you're in a small town commercial radio station. So as a result, you get people passing through those commercial stations, and you don't have news departments, you don't have all of that. But these public radio stations, across Wyoming and Dakota and Iowa and everywhere else, they become such a part of the community that they become local cultural institutions for news, but also for jazz and classical music and everything else. And
Yeah. Well, one more question from Towson, and then I'm going to have one more question at the very end. Towson, do you have a question?
Martha, you mind if I ask one?
No, please do. It's my course. There's a professor in the classroom.
I'm actually off the thing, I think. But I was wondering if you could comment a little bit. I'm sure you probably read it or heard about it, the big Politico article recently about how the White House press corps is not too pleased with the Obama administration, and they quoted a lot of people. They're closed in their access, and that they're not any different than the Bush administration. And I was wondering what you thought of that piece. If you read that piece, I can't remember if you were quoted in that piece or not. And then there have been a couple other pieces, and I wonder if your experience tracks with what that piece was conveying.
Yeah, I read that piece. I think it was a week or two ago.
I
think the complaints as represented in that piece were pretty accurate. I mean, there is frustration. Now, obviously, when the piece is about frustration in the White House, it might make it seem like that's all there is. And certainly, you know, I have plenty of meaningful conversations and good conversations with sources inside the building and in the administration. So, you know, it's not that there's no access. It's not that every day we're just at loggerheads trying to get anything out of them. But there are a lot of ways that they're very similar to the Bush administration, and they like to control the message, and there have not been enough news conferences, and there have not been enough opportunities for those of us who are not getting, interviews all the time to ask questions of the president. And there are a lot of ways that they do try to go around us, which is absolutely their right to do, but it is frustrating. It is an adversarial relationship. It was with the Bush administration. It is with the Obama administration. It was with the Clinton administration. That is as it should be. Maybe part of the surprise is the people who wrongly thought that it was this love fest between the Obama administration and the press. That was never the case. That is not the case. So it may really be a shock if that's where you're coming from before you read the story. But absolutely, there are a lot of things that we get frustrated about every single day in dealing with it.
My question is, how do you see your relationship with the public? Do you believe that you're a surrogate for the public? And do you try to ask questions and look into areas that you think that the public is interested in? How do you see them? Do you have a particular type? Do you have like a person you keep in mind that you're say a lot of people is their mother?
Yeah, I do think I am representing the public, and I do think I am the public's eyes and ears. I know I'm not going to have every question the public has, and a lot of the public is going to think I asked a stupid question. Some are going to be thankful for the question I asked, and some are going to love my story, and some are going to hate my story. But I certainly think I'm obligated to our listeners. I mean, I do have a sense of what an NPR listener wants from me in this job, and any story I cover, really. And I try my best on every story to explain it as clearly as possible, to be, to be an honest broker when I put that story together. To represent the truth. I don't have an axe to grind politically or anything. It doesn't matter what my personal opinions are. It's they're irrelevant. You don't care what my personal opinions are, so I'm not going to indulge you by sharing them and making them part of my story. I feel a real responsibility to the public. And in terms of who I think of, I only really think of one person when I write, because radio is a very personal medium. We have this audience of 20 million people, but every single one of you who listen one at a time, in your car, in your kitchen, you know, when your alarm clock goes off in the morning, in the shower, when you're up for a jog with your earphones in, we are talking to 28 million people, but one at a time. So when you write your story, you don't write to the stadium full of people or the city full of people. You have to picture somebody. And I mean, my mother is gone now, but for 20 years, I pictured my mom, you know, a very bright lady in her kitchen with her radio on, listening to NPR, and she'd have distractions. The phone would ring. She'd have to do this. She'd have to help my dad with something. So I would be aware very much of her life and her surroundings as I wrote the story. And I figured, if I'm explaining it to mom, I'm in good shape. You know, I mean, she's a good, smart member of our audience. And it was nice to write to her every story. And she's gone and I'm still writing. I just do, yeah.
That's very nice. Well, thank you very much, Don.
This is fun. Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you all.